Well, as we seek the Lord's help, can we turn back in our Bibles to the passage that we read together, the second passage in John chapter 18. John chapter 18. And we can read again verses 7 and 8. John 18 at verse 7. And he, that's Jesus, asked them, "Who is it you want?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." "I told you that I am he," Jesus answered. "If you're looking for me, then let these men go." If you're looking for me, then let these men go. These few words there, they encapsulate the gospel. Jesus says, "Take me, but let them go." We see there not just his willingness to give of himself, but simultaneously his desire to save those around him. So I want to look with you tonight at the events that surround the arrest of Jesus. We refer to it as his arrest. I think the NIV puts that heading on it. But really it was a surrender more than an arrest. It was a surrender. They may have come looking for him with swords and clubs, but they needn't have, because Jesus gave himself willingly into their hands. Look at verse 4. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" And these words themselves are amazing words. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him. The full impact of these words can only really be understood when we think about what Jesus was going through just moments before this in the Garden of Gethsemane, as the reality of all that lay ahead of him bore down upon him. We read it from Matthew's Gospel that Jesus, just before this, had been on his knees praying, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." The horror of what he was realizing was coming upon him weighed so heavy on his soul that he, for a time at least, was looking for a way out. He was in agony of soul. He had just confided in his three closest friends. "My soul," he said, "is overwhelmed with sorrow, even to the point of death." And his prayer in Gethsemane had been, "Father, is there any other way but this?" And yet as he continued to pray to the Father, and having been strengthened by the angel that was sent from heaven, his prayer then became, "Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away, may your will be done." And now we see him here, and he goes willingly, and he goes unflinchingly, and he goes determined to do his Father's will, because his hour had come. His hour had now come. Earlier in this gospel, I think it's in chapter 7, we read that no one laid hands on him because his hour had not yet come. But all that's about to change. They will now lay hands on him, because that hour has arrived. Now Jesus, even at this point, could easily have walked away. We read there somewhere in that passage that his enemies, they fell to the ground. He could have just walked over them. But he didn't. He went willingly. He went submissively, like a lamb to the slaughter. And yet, at the same time, John's account makes so clear to us that Jesus here is in complete control of all the events that take place surrounding his arrest. It wasn't an unfortunate mistake. It was his whole purpose in coming into this world, to give his life a ransom for many. So I want to look at these verses that we read here in John 18, verses 1 to 14 tonight. Four headings. We'll look first of all at his mastery of the situation, the fact that he's the one who's in control. We'll look secondly at his majesty. When he speaks, it becomes clear that he's no mere man. He's much more than that. His majesty. His mercy, thirdly. And his meekness, fourthly. So these will be our headings tonight. His mastery, his majesty, his mercy, and his meekness. Let's look at his mastery, first of all. So I want to see, under this heading, how all these events that take place, they're not being led by Judas or by the officials of the high priest or any of his enemies. They are all being led by Jesus. He is the mastermind of all these events. We read earlier in the gospel that he set his face resolutely towards Jerusalem. And we see this control of his in that they don't have to hire a private detective to locate Jesus. He goes exactly where he always went. He goes exactly where he knows they'll come looking for him. You see that in verse 2. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Jesus intentionally walks into their hands. Now Judas, the betrayer, he comes looking for him with a small army, basically. Rough, tough soldiers. There's some officials from the high priest. There's the goody-two-shoes, Pharisees. It's a real motley crew that have come together for this one purpose, to get Jesus. Here were people who would never normally work together. The chief priests, they'd have been Sadducees. They didn't see eye to eye with the Pharisees. They didn't normally cooperate on things. But they would here, in a common aim to rid the earth of Jesus. And they're not the only ones. A little bit later on at his trial, we read that Pilate sent Jesus to Herod. And that on that day, Herod and Pilate became friends. They'd previously been enemies. And yet they too will work together to get rid of Jesus. And you know, we see that still today. We see that in our own nation. We have political parties that are at loggerheads over pretty much every other issue, apart from sidelining Christianity, sidelining the gospel. They're all on the same wavelength then. It's not new. It was there 2,000 years ago. Everybody jumps on the bandwagon to silence Jesus. We're told here that they came with torches and lanterns. So they clearly they were expecting to have to search for someone who was in hiding. That wasn't the case. Unlike the first Adam, who went into hiding in the garden, this last Adam doesn't hide. Jesus doesn't just go where they will find him. He actually walks right up to them and introduces himself in verse 4. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" Just pause for a moment over these words. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him. How much do you think he knew? The passage tells us he knew it all. He knew all of it. He knew the scourging that was coming. He knew the mocking that he would face. He knew the sneering, the beating, the spitting. He knew that they would tear out his beard. He knew that nails would pierce his hands and his feet. He knew that a spear would pierce his side. He knew that a crown of thorns would pierce his forehead. Jesus knowing all. And yet there was no other way that sin could be paid for and sinners could be set free but this. Knowing all that was going to happen. You know, you almost want to insert the word despite in there. Despite knowing all that was going to happen to him, he went out and said, "Who is it you want?" So what we see here is that Jesus is the one who's in complete control. He's taking the lead. He's not in any way shirking or hiding from his enemies. He is in complete control of this situation. His mastery. You know, this small army, they came expecting to find a cowering fugitive. But instead they met this commanding figure, Jesus of Nazareth. So that's the first thing tonight, his mastery. His mastery. But I want to look secondly at his majesty. And to notice here that this is no mere man. that they have come to arrest. This is none other than the God man. So in answer to his question, who is it you want? They say, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus answers, verse 5, I am he. Well, he doesn't actually. He just says, I am. The word he is added to help make sense of it for us. And if any of you use the older versions, the King James version, you'll probably find the word he is in italics to show us that it's been added. It's been added to help us understand what he said. So does it matter whether he said he or not? Well, it does. It matters because in just saying I am, Jesus was taking the name of God to himself. Remember, that's the name God chose to use of himself when he spoke to Moses through the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3. And he was telling Moses that he was sending him down to Egypt to lead the Israelites out, and Moses was reluctant to go, and Moses said, who shall I say sent me? And God said, tell them I am sent you. Tell them I am sent you. I am is the name that God uses to describe himself. And Jesus had used it one other time in John's Gospel. It's in chapter 8. I think it's the last verse of chapter 8. Where Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. And you read that and you think, is the grammar a wee bit wrong there? It just doesn't sound right. Before Abraham was, I am. But it was Jesus teaching even then that he was God. He was God. He is God. He was with God before time began. I am denotes existence without beginning or end. It's not I was. It's not I will be. It's I am. God, the one who's the same yesterday, today, and forever. So by using this name to answer his enemies, Jesus was reminding them that he was God. And if they didn't have the theological understanding to grasp that fact, they should have worked it out when they all fell to the ground in a heap at a word from his mouth. Verse 6 tells us that. He says, I am. And we read, when Jesus said, I am he, or I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. Here we see the majesty of Jesus. His army, small army, came to arrest a man, to arrest Jesus of Nazareth. And now 200 or so soldiers are lying on the ground at just a word from his mouth. You know, it shows us the difference between his enemies and his friends. His enemies fall backwards trying to get away from him. His friends fall on their faces in worship of him. Here was none other than the King of Glory, who could so easily, as I said already, he could have easily have left these people pinned to the ground and just walked away. But Jesus doesn't walk away. In fact, he takes the initiative again, verse 7, and he asks them again, who is it you want? And they reply the same thing, Jesus of Nazareth. How on earth they didn't just get out of there at that point? They've witnessed his power. They've experienced his power. And that they fell to the ground when he spoke. You'd think, even if they didn't grasp that he was God, that they would have understood that there's some supernatural power here that they should get out of there. But they didn't. Because they were blind. They were spiritually blind. The devil had blinded them. And you know, friends, we would be like them tonight, were it not for the Lord opening your eyes and showing you that Jesus is more than just a mere man from Nazareth. That he is the Lord of glory. That he is God. The God-man before whom no one can stand but those for whom he gave himself. So that's the second thing tonight. His majesty. We saw his mastery, we saw his majesty. Thirdly, I want to consider his mercy. His mercy. So we're looking at verse 8. We read it at the start. where he says, if you're looking for me, then let these men go. Even in the middle of his arrest, Jesus is putting others before himself. As the good shepherd who's just about to lay down his life for his sheep, his great burden is that his sheep will be safe. And so he says, if it's me you're after, then let these people go. Let them go. What a great display of mercy. At a time of crisis in his life, when you have a crisis in your life, you want those close to you to stay close to you. You want those who can help you to be around you. But Jesus here was more concerned to protect them than he was to protect himself. And here we see the substitutionary nature of Jesus' sacrifice. He died in our place, taking our penalty. Here he's saying, let him go, but take me. And he still says that. Let her go, take me instead. I'll take his place. I'll take her place. But I'll be sure to let them go. You know, John adds a note then in verse 9 of explanation. He says, this happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave me. And you know, that is as true tonight as it was when these words were first spoken. I have lost none of those you gave me. And he never will lose any whom the Father has given him, because he stood in that place and he took their penalty and he drank the cup of the Father's wrath in your place tonight, if you're a Christian. Twice he asks him, who is it you want? Maybe so that after they have twice said they are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, he could then say so clearly, so it's not these disciples, you can let them go. His mercy. And you know, his mercy is amazing because it's not just shown here to his followers, to his disciples, to those closest to them. But in this incident in Gethsemane at his arrest, his mercy is shown even to his enemies. Because you find Peter there in verse 10, who has no intention of letting this army take his master captive. He pulls out a sword and he takes a swipe at the main man from the temple, the servant of the high priest, Malchus. I assume that Peter was probably trying to take his head off, but he was not as good a swordsman as he was a fisherman, and he just gets Malchus' ear. But here we see the mercy of Jesus. Because although John doesn't tell us this, the other Gospels do, that Jesus healed Malchus' ear. This was the last healing miracle Jesus performed before he went to the cross. And it was done to an enemy. It was done to one who wanted him dead. His mercy. His mercy. Let's move on. We've looked at his mastery, his majesty, his mercy. Fourthly, his meekness. His meekness. So look at verse 11. Jesus commanded Peter, put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? He may be the one who's in charge of all these events. He may be the one who has all the power. He's the one who can wipe out his enemies in an instant. But his great and ultimate desire is to do his Father's will, to fulfill the purpose for which he came, and to give his life a ransom for many. Do you know, we read in verse 12, the end of verse 12, they bound him. They bound him. And then they led him away. And I want to consider just for a moment before we finish why they bound him. Why was Jesus bound when he didn't put up a fight? He was basically handing himself over. They didn't need to bind him. He was going willingly with them. Well, I think maybe it's symbolic. It's to picture. It's a picture for us. It's a picture for us of other ways in which Jesus was bound to see this through. So he was bound, first of all, by his love for you. You see, he had pledged himself in the what we call the eternal covenant, that great agreement within the Trinity before the world ever was. He had pledged that he would come and he would die in place of sinners. He had pledged that he would go the way of the cross. And so he was bound by love for you. But he was also bound by obedience to the Father. That's what he lived for. And that's what he died for. My food, said Jesus in John chapter 4, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. So he's bound to conclude that work so that he will be able to say from the cross, it is finished. It is finished. So he was bound by love for you. He was bound by obedience to the Father, but he was also bound to fulfill all that had been prophesied about him throughout the Old Testament. Isaiah had prophesied about this exact thing, that he was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. He's going meekly. He didn't object, and yet he's bound. I think the same was probably true of Isaac in Genesis 22. He was bound by his father Abraham, even though there's no suggestion, no hint that he struggled. So too Jesus went meekly, without objection. So when we read there that he was bound, they bound him, verse 12. He needn't have been bound by his enemies, because he was bound in so many other ways to see this through. And I guess ultimately, he was bound so that sinners could be loosed. By nature, we're the ones that are bound. We're bound by sin and we're bound by Satan. And the only way you can be set free is by the way of the cross. If the Son shall set you are free indeed. But let us also remember this, that Jesus didn't deserve to be bound. He had done nothing wrong. That is the testimony even of Pilate, who tried him. But this man has done nothing amiss. It was the testimony of the thief on the cross beside him as well. Same thing. He's done nothing wrong. And yet in his innocence, Jesus was bound and led away. And it appears so unseemly. An innocent man. I used to attend court quite often. I was a journalist for a while, and sometimes you would see, since they started, everybody who appears in the dock has to be cuffed now. And sometimes you would see someone coming in who maybe later turned out to be innocent, and you could just tell this person had never been in that situation before. They would come into the dock cuffed, flanked by police officers. And they looked so out of place. They looked so uncomfortable. It looked so unseemly. And so too, to imagine Jesus bound. The only sinless man that ever lived. The only perfect man. The man who was without sin. But he was bound because he was being made sin for us. And yet all of this, all of it, orchestrated by himself. He's the one with all the power. He's the one who is in control. He didn't go as a victim. He went to be a victor, knowing that through his death, sin and Satan would be defeated. And that's why, in that upper room, when Judas dipped his bread in the dish, that Jesus said, now is the Son of Man glorified. Now is the Son of Man glorified. The way of the cross then. It's the way of suffering, of beating, of crushing, and of death. And yet it was the way by which Jesus would be glorified, and the way by which you would be saved. And he, knowing all that was going to happen to him, he walked that way, meekly, willingly, intentionally, saying, "Take me, but let them go. May the curse be on me, but not on them." We looked at his mastery. He's in complete control. We considered his majesty. This is no mere man, this is the God man. We spoke about his mercy. Even in his arrest, his concern was for others. And we've just considered his meekness. That he goes without a fight. He goes willingly. He goes humbly. One final M, just in a word. His mandate. What is his mandate? For us as his followers, it is, do this in remembrance of me. Do this in remembrance of me. It ought to be a pleasure to do that. Sometimes I think we get nervous before a communion. We start to worry that we're not what we should be. We tie ourselves in knots. I don't think that is ever what Jesus intended. He gave this meal of the Lord's Supper to encourage his people, to build his people up. He did that also when he's knowing he was just about to go to the cross. His concern was for us, that we would be fed, that we would be built up, that we would have fellowship with him. And yet we tie ourselves in knots and get nervous and afraid. We allow Satan to discourage us rather than thinking about Jesus encouraging us. So that's his mandate. Do this in remembrance of me. So let us, by his grace, come with joy to his table tomorrow, God willing. May he bless to us these thoughts.